Hello and welcome to the podcast for episode 115, Wentworth Prison. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outland series, and I'm happily joined today by...
Ira Stephen Bear.
Who wrote this episode.
Indeed.
And the whiskey today is Talisker.
Here you go. Cheers.
Cheers. Another episode down. All right, well, Wentworth, you know, when we were breaking the show initially into the 16 components, I think we always set aside two episodes to sort of tell the story of Jamie at Wentworth and Claire's rescue of him, and then the aftermath, and splitting those up into the last two episodes of the season. I don't think that ever really changed as we were going through the story break process. And the story outline for this and the story break are pretty close to the final episode, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there are very few changes. We made some changes in the post-production, but this one held together quite well. And here we are in Scotland together. Last time we did this for episode 10, I think we were in Kathmandu. Is that where we were?
Yes, now we are here at Cumbernauld doing the podcast. Oh, now this title card, this is a series of torture implements that, where did we get these? Did they create these?
I think they got them, which is a scary thought.
Yeah, that they're lying around here someplace. Wentworth Prison itself, the exterior, this is that was a combination of an actual building in Carlisle and then a CG to kind of clean it up and make it look a little bit more forbidding.
Oh yeah, there you go. This was, I felt that this was my little homage to Waiting for Godot, the idea of Jamie and Macquarie talking about what happens to you when you're hung, whether you void your bowels or whether you have an orgasm. In Godot, they keep talking about hanging themselves in order to have an orgasm, and I thought it would be funny if you were ever actually faced with such a fate, you know, what that outcome would be.
I remember the gallows here was something that they built, and it was sitting on the sound stages for quite a while. We went down at one point and saw a demonstration of how this was going to work, this right. Three-sided gallows with Anna Forster, the director, and Gary Steele, our production designer, and the stunt guys. And there's something just profoundly disturbing about watching them put guys in this noose, even though you know they're stunt players and you know that they've got the harness on underneath, and then kicking them off this platform. It's just, it's a very disturbing thing to watch.
And then Anna got obsessed with this gentleman who's going up to be hung. They put a device on him so he actually could void his bowels as he was being brought up to the gallows, which was not the idea. It was when you were hung, and then the device went off by mistake while he was waiting for his time on screen, so he was walking around with this big blotch on the back of his pants, and we decided, let's just cut the whole thing and forget it. But he had a very unique nickname that we kept saying every time we had to reference that guy.
Yeah, it was Shit Your Pants.
Shit Your Pants.
So it's Anna kept, and hearing Anna say it was very funny, because she would just, and then Shit Your Pants comes up, and
yeah.
while Shit Your Pants is on the stage.
And I was trying to explain that it wasn't the idea that he's doing it when he's walking up, but once his neck snaps.
I really like the fact that we brought Macquarie over into this episode.
Yeah, he has a good death here.
To think my last view of the world will be a bunch of ill-fought, pasty-faced Englishmen. My only regret is that I wasted my life.
Well, this was like a full day of shooting, wasn't it? This
was it
like
certainly
just to do this
was.
Day.
And I was getting sick when we were in Carlisle, and Meryl Davis was frightened that she would catch it since we were always together. And the following day, when we did the beginning of episode 16, when I came to the set in worse shape than I was Miss Day. She sent me home, and I had to take that two-hour car drive back to Glasgow feeling absolutely wretched. And then I got back, and they had sent me all this... all these medicines to get well quickly. It was just absolutely foul to get sick on location.
This was like the last, was this literally the last location we shot? Was that at Carlisle? And then came back to the stages for the end of the show?
No, after that, I believe we did McCranick. Or maybe McCranick came before this. Yeah, this was probably it. This was probably it. I think we did McCranick before that.
And this is a fair distance from our studio.
2 hours.
Yeah. So this was a what we call an overnight, because you had to put the crew up in the cast overnight because you couldn't practically drive out there and back on the same day. So this was a fairly distant location for everyone on the crew.
Yeah, this is Northern England.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. This is just over the border. Yay.
The heroes rescuing Jamie, last minute rescue,
which I always love. There was debate. There were feelings that no, it's not play him coming to the rescue. They do this in some other way. But I was always, I think this was your idea in the story break, right?
Right.
And I was always enamored of this idea of him because it is such a flip on the traditional hero comes to the rescue.
And it just sets the stage for their complicated relationship.
Tobias comfortable on a horse? Because he certainly seems like it.
Yeah, he came in without any trouble whatsoever. And, you know, we wanted him to come in at a gallop, and he did it, and he was fine with it. And then he was just clocking Jamie in every take, that look.
Like that shot right there.
Yeah.
Because he backs the horse up just a couple of steps and then turns its head. It's really nice.
I think he asked to do that, actually. I think he wanted to. Yeah, he definitely had very strong feelings about that moment.
Now, this is back on our soundstage. We built the entire prison cell, and the corridors are back on our soundstages here at Cumbernauld. So this was like a very unpleasant little place to go shoot. They had wanted, initially, there was much discussion about putting a window in this set to allow a little daylight in, mostly for the cinematographer and the director to sort of have to light the set. But I was pretty adamant on the point that I wanted this to be very much, you know, the pit of hell, where there was no hope, you couldn't contact the outside world, and that everything that happened in this cell was sort of took place out of space and out of time, and you were just in this weird bubble of hell trapped with this man. And as a result, it's pretty dark in here.
And the 5 days, I think, 5 or 6 days we shot in this cell, which covers 15 and 16, we'll discuss it more in 16, but it was without a doubt the most unpleasant, most trying 6 days I've ever been on a set, and everyone felt it. It was not a fun time watching those scenes get shot.
Now, this sequence in the warden's office, this is sort of pretty much the story straight out of the book of Claire going in and trying to talk her way to get to see Jamie, then trying to at least get a letter from Jamie, and finally walking away with only his worldly possessions. This actor is actually the man that played Jamie, a Highlander character in a Doctor Who episode, which inspired Diana Gabaldon to write the entire series way back in the day, back in the 60s or the early 70s. And so we thought it would be fun to cast him in this show, and it's great. It's just like a nice little inside bit of information for people that... And we'll pause right there because we're frozen. So that is how we came to get Fraser Hines for the role. And this is also on our sound stages. We built this. This is a revamp of what, Lollybrook's kitchen, I think?
Yeah.
This was the kitchen at Lollybrook at one point that we then doubled over to become the warden's office at Wentworth.
There was a lot of talk about that Bible and would we recognize that it was a Bible. And so we put the cross on the cover.
And we picked it up. We had to go back. Yeah. It was an insert shot. We shot months later, I think. Because we still didn't have something that was recognizably as a Bible on camera.
Yeah, I was always glad when I would have a scene from the book that I could actually use, you know?
Yeah.
And get some of the dialogue out of as a jumping off point.
Reconciliation. Yeah, this is a lot of dialogue from the book, as I recall.
Yeah.
I like this look on Katrina's face as he walks out of the room.
Oh, that's, yeah.
You cut back to her, and this is one of those, you know, when you have a great actress, she can just say without words, without voiceover, he walks out, he looks back, and then we come to her, and you just see it all come crashing in on her right here.
Yeah, I loved it on the set when she lowered her head, which was not in the script, and I just thought it was... You get it all there, that sigh, and how much it's taken out of her to play this role.
Yeah, because at the beginning of the scene, she's so confident, she's like so on her game and not giving away anything.
And then trying to see what was in this box.
Yeah. Lots of discussion in this box. How did the lid open? How deep could you see into the box? What was in the box? Everything in his sporran. Well, Jamie had like a Batman utility belt sporran. It had lots of things in it, evidently. There's a whole list of specific items that are in that box that were detailed in the script and in the book.
Absolutely.
Now, this exterior coming up was not at Carlisle. Where did we shoot this exterior? Here. Because I was there. I went down to the set.
Yeah, you came down.
To the location. I don't remember where this was. This is not Carlisle, and it's not here. This was in another town somewhere. This is another castle or palace.
And then we had the... whether or not she was going to heave on camera or not. And then we kind of, sort of, kind of, yes, but nothing too
grotesque. But it was like a little tube running up the side of Katrina, and there's a guy off camera pumping it through, and how many takes before it came out.
And whether or not Duncan would be able to lift her and hold the box, and whether the box disappear... And there was a whole long walk that he did that we cut. Now, this scene drove me. This is day one of this block. And a lot about this scene I didn't want to get too intrusive right away. But number one, Angus and Rupert were not supposed to be laughing. They were supposed to be losing heavily and not liking it, which made the other two guys feel confident to get them to speak.
Right.
But then they're acting like, oh, we're losing money. It's so great because we're so drunk, which is a way to go. But it was not what was in the script by any means. So that was one part of it. Then this was how annoyed these guys were going to be with, you know, how much they were going to believe that Angus and Rupert
were just screwing off.
And then when these guys, I had this theory that drove me nuts in Seven, the wedding show with Angus and Rupert. When Angus and Rupert are together and doing their thing, as with all great comedy teams, you need to have them in a two-shot. This is okay. It's not what I... Because you don't see his face. You're supposed to have them equal size. It always worked for every great comedy team. Name your comedy team. And we never got the actual shot, so they never got the rhythm, because this had a very nice rhythm, the dialogue, and it never played the way it was supposed to. See, they keep cutting.
Yeah.
You never see them together. They're proud of one another. They're buddies. So we wound up having to cut into this scene things that that should have been quite nice.
Because comedy's all about timing.
Yeah.
And the actors are handing it off to each other and taking little subtle cues. The more time they do it, the better they get at it. But we didn't really have the coverage in this particular angle. Rupert keeps looking off towards Angus, so you don't see the look on his face half the time.
So that drove me a little bit crazy on day one. But I've recovered. And these boys are so good that they're still able to sell it.
I think that set is a revamp of Castle Leon's kitchen, which I think you can sniff out by those big giant arches. Those big arches used to be part of her fireplace at the Castle Leon set. This took a little bit of restaging, and we had to do an insert shot here. He didn't quite come through the angle that he was pulling, because you had to see visually this reference, because Randall has this very specific line about he who pulls the stone. Well, you had to see him pulling in that angle, and in the initial cut, you didn't see it, and the line kind of fell flat, so we had to go back and do a pickup shot there of the chain being pulled.
And Marley's character, who is in the book, we had a lot of discussion in the room.
Discussion of Marley.
You know, whether he was going to be a developmentally disabled kind of a character, more of a Mongo type,
right,
or if he was just unable to speak, or was it that he just didn't speak, but he could speak, and how aware he was of what was going on. Lots and lots of discussions about that, though I think Richard Ashton, who in real life, by the way, is quite a talkative individual,
yeah,
and has a long career on stage and can speak about playwrights in the theater with great knowledge, he actually wound up, I think, doing a really nice job. He's imposing, he's scary, but he's not a cliche. He's not over the top. At least I don't think he is.
And it was very tricky in terms of what's he doing, where is Marley. I remember lots of discussion with Anna when they were rehearsing, because there was a lot of rehearsal in 15 and 16 for all the Jack, Randall, Jamie stuff. We'd set aside specific days for the actors to rehearse by themselves and with the director. There was a lot of conversation about where Marley's standing at key points and when he would interfere or not, and did he understand it. It just kind of complicated all the choreography of who does what and when here.
You've presented to the court of session
that they would find nothing.
I had to think what would happen to me.
We actually, I believe, Ron, in the editing, you actually cut down some of Randall in this scene, some of his reactions, some of the moments, because we didn't need it. It got to be too much. He was almost, the character was coming off as too diabolical.
Yeah, that's right. There was a lot more. It was just more reactions and a couple more lines, I think, from Jack that got cut there, because it kind of felt like there's a long way to go with this character, and I think we'd gotten there too fast in the initial scene.
Duncan had a lot of fun with this, playing the kind of subservient.
Oh, I love, there's a look on his face at one point where the guy kind of looks at him and he kind of has this grin, this goofy, like, what are you going to do? I'm a dope.
We looked through a lot of people to get this guard, who did quite well. We looked at a lot of people. It seems like a simple role, but it was difficult. We didn't want someone who seemed too unintelligent or too easily fooled, or on the other hand, too powerful that he would get it too quickly. It took some time. You never know which role is going to become a bit of a problem. But I think he really did some nice reactions here.
Of course. My apologies. BD,
Murtaugh with his eyes down.
I know.
Don't look at the...
Yeah, I think it's right here. That.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Don't. Not me. Not little old me.
There was a ton of stuff in this place. Papers. I mean, they really filled it up.
Now, all of this is sort of extrapolated. A lot of this, you know, in the book version, you know, because it's told completely from Claire's point of view, all of the stuff with between Jamie and Jack is related to her after the fact, after Jamie is ultimately rescued and looking back on the events, he tells her the story of what happened. And because we sort of opened the point of view to include Jamie in episode 109, that in a lot of ways gave us permission to sort of cut over and now tell this story from Jamie. So that's like the key structural difference from the book, is that now we can actually go in real time and see what's actually happening with Jack and Jamie while Claire is trying to sneak through the prison and go find him. Shaken,
sweaty. Yeah, I think one of the things we talked about in the room was obviously Blackjack has a goal, which is to possess Jamie. But so that it was to make it a little more interesting, a little more complicated. I came up with the idea of the giving him the noble death, so that it was a two-way street.
Right.
That in its own kind of screwed-up way, Blackjack really was, you know, making a contract with Jamie. That he wasn't just taking; he was willing in his own mind to give. And in a way, it showed that, or I hope it shows that, besides wanting to possess Jamie, break Jamie, have Jamie, whatever you want to call it, he wanted to give something back. He was willing. He did care enough about Jamie, or he was obsessed about Jamie, that you know, the thought of Jamie hanging, that kind of a death that he just found repugnant and wanted to help him to a more graceful death.
And I also thought that, and I still think it's important in a way that you believe that here, because later, you know, by the end of this episode, he makes a deal with, you know, Jamie posits a contract of his own. Let her go and I'll give you what you want. Well, that only holds if you think Jack is a person who will hold to his word, who's willing to do contracts. So I think that is, I think it really does shore up that aspect of the tale, that Jack is a man of his word on a certain level, as he sees it, and in this circumstance, he is willing to make a contract that he will abide by.
Just the fact that he did ride to the rescue.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have stood there if he wanted to and just watched Jamie be hung, and that would have put an end to it. But it is, as I said, more complicated than that.
All of these things between them, I mean, this all was the subject of a lot of conversation in the writer's room with the director, the actors. The actors spent a lot of time, just the two of them, talking over the script, talking over their characters and how they would go back and forth. And the choreography of all this was thought about meticulously. This was, everyone, I think, going into the show knew where the series was going. And these last two episodes, I think, loomed large in everyone's minds. So by the time we got here, everyone sort of really knew that this was a big deal, and we all took it very seriously, and everyone knew that, you know, we were exhausted, and this was the end of a very long shoot. But everyone really held something in reserve so that they could really give it their all in these two episodes.
Yeah, the crew, everyone was extremely focused, and the kind of hearty good fellowship, the jokes were kept to a minimum. It was definitely a job to get through this. Now, this was a moment that didn't quite work the way I had planned it. This is all fine, but the button of this scene went. Yeah, that's a great moment, but what it was supposed to be was he was supposed to be looking at her like they're still in the conversation, and she leaves, and he's looking after her like, for all they know, they'll never see each other again. This could all blow up in their face. And so I always saw him saying that to her back or after she's gone. And instead, it's this thoughtful thing he just says to himself. Small thing, but we writers, we see something in our heads, and it just doesn't quite.
Yeah, it's hard because you're always. I mean, when I write, I'm always playing the movie in my head.
Yep.
How I think it's going to play, and you're always sort of being surprised that it plays slightly differently. Sometimes better, but sometimes missing the elements that you thought were there when you wrote it. I think all this creeping with Claire is a combination of location and our
yes,
sets as well.
Both. This was all location.
I'll be for Jim Glass. Come and get me.
She did a lot of creeping.
There's a lot of, yeah, there's miles of creeping that we cut just to sort of pick up the pace here a little bit, but she crept through a lot of corridor.
Here's our Pirates of the Caribbean moment.
Right.
Whoa, you'd make a fine buccaneer.
Arr,
matey.
Come closer, my lass.
Come on, Jamie, you only have one choice, and you know it. There's the brazier.
Oh, the brazier. That hanging fire brazier in the room tortured me endlessly. Because I was afraid it was going to interfere. I mean, truth to tell, in the final result, I don't think it's as bad as I thought it was going to be. In fact, it's fine.
Well, also, we said, Don't
worry. Yeah.
Don't show it whenever you can. So otherwise, at the time, it was right in between them. You know,
it was hanging in the middle of the set, and I was concerned that it was just going to distract every shot, and that people would be constantly sort of dancing around it.
Plus the fact that it's a weapon.
Yeah.
He wanted to use it.
I know. I keep waiting for him to grab it and swing it in the.
But now it's not in any of these shots, so it's just not part of. You know, if the audience is thinking about that, we're in trouble. And we still don't know whether he's understanding or not understanding Marley. He's watching very closely, but how much of it he's...
What is he thinking about? Is he thinking? Is he watching Jamie's hair?
I know he's probably hungry. He's a big boy.
I like the way Jack measures out the distance carefully as he walks around the backside of Jamie.
Yes.
Marley, do you speak English?
It's like, when do we kill someone? He's thinking. I thought we were coming here to kill someone. Or torture them at the least.
Yeah, this isn't any fun. When's lunch?
You're the broken one. You're the one that sees my face every night.
Yeah, see, this is tricky, because it's like, how long do you let Marley stand by before he goes in? When does he understand? What is his understanding?
Well, what we discussed down there with Richard, who played Marley, was, you know, Blackjack is the man, and he's just there to kind of do what he's told to do. So if Blackjack suddenly gets into a confrontation, he felt he needed to wait to see if Blackjack was going to take care of business before he moved in. That's at least the, you know, he doesn't get into the action until he's needed into the action, is what we came up with. And then I think this surprises people who haven't read the book.
I like that.
The idea of protecting Jamie is, I find, very interesting. I know it's for a nefarious, you know, finale of that he's thinking of, but the fact that he just refuses to let him die ignobly is...
Yeah, and precipitously.
Right.
When it's not on his timetable.
And the real mallet was really heavy.
Oh, yeah.
There was a rubber one, obviously, but the real one was freaking heavy. When I picked it up, it was like, whoa.
Yeah, it was a scary implement. Lots of... This took a lot of time and effort. That's a prosthetic hand. And how many times does he smash the hand? What does Claire hear in the corridor and when? It was all about trying to figure out... Something had to draw her down that corridor. She had to hear Jamie's cries, but how many times did he hit him with that hammer, and how many times could the hand physically sustain it? How mangled was it going to be? Just lots of... I can't even tell you how many hours talking with those prosthetics people, with the director, then spending time in editing, trying to figure all the timing of all this out. Now there, I think this is, I think it's a salute to how well the makeup artist did this, is that there's a lot of times when Jamie's holding the hand, sometimes it's actually his hand with blood and makeup on top of it, sometimes it's a completely fake prosthetic hand, and right now I don't think you can tell the difference.
Now, if you remember, because of this moment here is why we went back in post and we had him hit the hand more than once.
Right.
Because the feeling was the one blow wasn't enough, though it would have been enough for me if it was my hand, trust me.
Because you had to get Jamie to a point where he was almost delirious, he was in such incredible pain, and the one hammerhead, I think we did saw it, that was in the original cut,
right.
We saw it that way, it was one hit, and it didn't quite feel like it was enough to put him into that sort of, you know, surreal state.
I, of course, would have been in shock immediately, and would not have even known what was going on from here on in. Now Marley is not happy.
Marley,
his beautiful really face. It's always not the face. Not the face. See, even now, Jack pulls back. This is so important to him. He doesn't want it to be... He has a fantasy in his head, and he wants that fantasy to play out. Somehow it's going to play out. And that's the moment where it could have just turned into, in his mind, ugliness. Though it's ugly anyway as we get to it, but not you know.
Well, it's great that he won't even let himself interfere with his fantasy, because he's pulling himself back.
Right.
It's like, I won't allow my own passions to overwhelm. It's like even his own nature he's going to somehow restrain.
Talisker is good, huh?
Talisker is
nice,
good.
Nice, nice, smoky, not over smoky.
It's not the super peaty of Lagavulin.
Yep. Yeah, we had tons of this, of her,
of Claire. So and this is a subtle thing. This is a hard one because we're doing this completely visually, which I like. You know, without a voiceover telling you every step of the way, but she opens the door to the outside, finding an escape route. Takes the bolt. Now she's taking the bolt out of the door because that keeps it from being latched.
Claire Claire really is an amazing woman. You know, with all the fear about Jamie, she still just maintains control. You know, it's
she's very smart. That's why I always said about her. It's her intelligence that I always really responded to in this woman.
Of course, you know how much she loves him, but she still knows that finding him is not enough. There has to be an escape route. Now, this was another thing that the way it was in the book, which I kind of wrote, I believe, as the book, the break, trying to break the chain, it was just way too difficult and too many things, and too, it didn't quite make sense, but if you didn't explain it like you can in the book, that she's trying to break the lock by jamming the key in it. I know we cut a lot of, we simplified it.
Yeah, this went on a bit of her, and then he was trying to tell her how to do it, and it just went on and on a bit. And as I was watching, I kind of felt in editing that he needed to be more out of it in the scene, because in the next scene, he's pretty passive, and I think he had to buy that he was pretty much passed out from this point forward.
Yeah, we lost dialogue that was really unnecessary for a TV episode.
Yeah, it was him trying to tell her how to do it and her saying, the key doesn't fit, or there was a whole back and forth about it.
Yeah, you wanted a fucking sadistic piece of shit that he wouldn't understand, that even Randall wouldn't have quite followed what she was saying. We never got that shot.
Yeah. Yeah, like those words don't register with him.
Right. Yeah, I love that. She's a fit match for that. It's all about Jamie.
Yeah.
Claire is really, for him, she's not the prize, obviously.
Yeah, she's a mystery, a curiosity.
Yep.
You know, there's like, what's going on with this woman? But it's really about Jamie.
Now, this is one of those, the few moments, kind of like in Six, where we see the British Army and how, I mean, these guys, you know, they know the difference between right and wrong. They know something seriously off is going on in this cell, but because of the army, because of their upbringing as an officer, you know, they're just not going to save her, even if they might want to. They can't.
Yeah, I think it's more about that he's an officer rather than he's Black Jack Randall.
Right.
Because he just got here.
No, absolutely.
In. And he plays that. This is all about him knowing his power as an officer over these guys. Yes, sir. Because they could be spread out and getting flogged tomorrow if he just says so.
Who knows how that moment changed their lives of those two characters. We'll never know.
We should follow that. That should be the spinoff series. That should be the Golden Krantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah, exactly. Those guys. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's something no one wants to see.
This was a very disturbing moment in the book. I remember that. This is still such a just a bizarrely disturbing thing. He's going to hand her over to Marley.
Yes, Marley. You don't really have an idea of what Marley knows about women. You know, it seems like she could be an alien life form to Marley that he's trying to suss out.
This reminds me of that beat. I don't know if they consciously echoed it, but he takes her hair down. It reminds me of back in 108 when she was tying his stock.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like an interesting sort of, she was doing him up and now he kind of plays, you know, takes her hair down.
Mm.
I like that even Jack, it's like, no, even I don't want to watch that.
I don't think Tobias was too thrilled with this moment, and the fact that she could get the better of him.
Yeah, this was tough. It was also hard to stage this.
And I think he plays it a little bit like... No, I guess he didn't. I thought he played it like he was allowing her to do it, but he was never in any jeopardy, but I guess maybe we cut that. And we rightly cut what happened here.
Yes.
Where he used the mallet in a way that mallets should not be used.
Yes.
And that just was not in the script. And I understand the threat he was doing to try to get Jamie to agree, but it was a little too much.
Yeah, it was too far.
And then we had the whole thing about how, now that Marley is a corpse, how often do we see him?
Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
When do you cut to the corpse and remind him that he's still there? He's dead.
Through everything that's happening.
Wasn't there some suggestion they were going to do something with the corpse at one point? They were going to have something sitting on him?
No, it was more than that.
I can't.
Tobias came up with an idea that they would use Marley's corpse as a bed.
Oh,
let's
right.
Put it that way.
That's right.
And Anna got all excited about it and thought that was a great idea. And we said absolutely not. That's kind of really weird. And even Blackjack, why would he want to do that? So.
This I like a lot. The way Tobias picks up this piece of wood and just slowly pulls out that nail. It works it out. It's so like, you're not even quite sure what's going to happen here, but you know you don't like it.
And again, he's so deliberate.
Yeah.
He's so deliberate. And just moving those fingers would be so painful. Oh, it's just not pleasant. Just not pleasant. And here we definitely had, again, we added to the,
yeah.
Oh, shite. Not fun. Oh.
Yeah, it was how many times did he hit the nail to get under the table?
And I like the way that our doctor told us that, you know, that putting a nail through the palm of the hand isn't that bad.
Yeah, she was like, it's not that bad, actually.
It's like,
oh, really? She said, oh, the hammer's far worse.
Yeah, breaking the hand is far worse than the nail.
Because the nail just kind of goes in between the bones and says, yeah, it's over.
Yeah, that's a Tobias line. I'll give credit where credit is due.
We'll remember this moment the rest of our lives.
That's Tobias.
That's a good one.
I mean, that he didn't say it on the day. He came and said that and asked for it. And I said, okay.
Again, this only works if you believe Jack is going to keep his end of the bargain.
Right.
He's not going to take her outside the door and slit her throat. Jamie has to believe that.
Take your time.
Yeah, take your time. Don't rush back.
Now, this place was one... Not this, but
yeah,
this is coming up. which was at Carlisle. This is a truly scary location. This was in Carlisle. It's underground. When they went down there, it was just filled with insects and bugs and spiders. I'm telling you, this was not a pleasant place. And I remember when Kat went down there the first time, she came up and said, "Ugh, that's, you know," and they went down there and they got rid of, they used, I guess, flames to scare the bugs away. But they were falling on their clothes and on their heads. And when I went down there, it was just like, get me out of here. It was this little corridor, curving corridor. It was not pleasant. Again, you don't want to think what it was used for back in the day.
Nothing good happened in those corridors.
No. It's a nice shot. Yeah, I watched this from the Video Village. It was too tight for one thing, and I just didn't want to be down there.
One thing that will give away a location is how low that ceiling is.
Yep.
Because when you build a set, you always have higher ceilings for lights and camera. But that ceiling is so low and cramped, it has to be a location. That's so horrible. This is pretty nasty stuff, too.
Yeah, this was always in the script. I really felt it was a nice way to bring back Macquarie, surprise guest appearance in the middle of the show. And then when you see all these people who have been hung for whatever reason, you know, it's just tossed out there. It's just horrible.
Now in the book, there's a whole sequence here with a wolf. Obviously, actually more than one wolf. There's wolves.
I wrote it the first time.
We wrote it. We did. We were prepping it. There just came a point where, you know, to do wolves, to do wolf attacks, and, you know, to have her interact with the wolves, to have the wolf actually jumping on her, you had to be a combination of real animals and CGI 3D animals, and it just became crazy. And at a certain point, I just said, let's cut that and just get out of it. Because I felt it was more important to spend time and money and resources really developing Jack and Jamie and give that its due. And I cut the whole wolf thing. There is one tiny reference to it later in the woods. You'll hear a wolf in the background howling.
Yeah.
And that's our nod towards the book story.
No one on the writing staff fought for it. I mean, we tried to put it in, we gave it a shot, but everyone knew it would have been. Now this is one of my favorite lines that I've written for this series coming up. It's just a lot of fun writing for these characters, all of them. The dead flesh one.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
And he's just so crazy, this guy. His dark side, he just can't. He tries to control it, but it is difficult. And that fetish kind of thing. It's like something out of J.G. Ballard stories, you know, car crash victims and their wounds, only being able to make love in crash cars.
Yeah.
He needs to hurt the thing that he loves. I kid you not, these scenes were not easy to watch, and I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about crew guys who were the toughest guys. No one was enjoying it, and we have plenty more to come.
Yeah, it was a lot of laughter down on the set.
This is when I had the bright idea to get pizza for the entire crew. Just when we were shooting this, it was late at night. Half the crew was already gone. Yeah.
Oh, really?
And by the time the pizza arrived, it was just a mess. It was such a, it was one of those gallant gestures that were for naught, because people were getting out of there. Everyone who wasn't needed had gone. We were down to a skeleton crew. I was getting 40 pizza pies. It was like, for now on, pizza on the sound stages. Yeah. This is just
pizza on location.
Yeah, not a good idea.
We rejiggered this scene three or four times.
Yep.
The Krannic house, and who says what when, and I can't even remember the original order of events. We've changed this up so many different times. Because McCrannick in the book plays a little bit bigger role. He rescued her outside. He shot the wolf. We cut all that. But we wanted to still kind of preserve the idea of McCrannick and his connection to the pearls.
How many men can you muster?
Best to your husband, from my point of view. It's
not impossible. Tomorrow morning at the very latest.
Man.
There's a lot of expo in this scene.
Yeah.
And I give credit to the actors, because it doesn't lay there quite as much as it should, and I think that McCrannick actually, that the for some reason, this love of, you know, we've never seen Jamie's mom, Ellen, but she must have been quite a woman, you know?
Yeah.
Between
Ellen got around.
Murtaugh and McCrannick.
Lots of people were in love with Ellen McCrannick.
Unbelievable.
Where did you get these?
I mean, it's like he's back. What is it, 30 years or whatever?
20 years ago?
You know, it's like just like, it's
Ellen,
like, oh my
is
God.
Is she here?
Is she,
is she in the prison? Then we're going.
And this was another call. Oh, during the filming of this scene, all anyone was concerned about was at the end of the night we were bringing in cows. And everyone was just freaking out because we knew we didn't want to go over. And we had like 30 cows, 20 cows, whatever it was. And all people were talking about all night was what happens when they come. What if they stampede? Or what if they won't be facing the right way? All the whole night was waiting for these cows to make their appearance. Because this was all obviously location, and we weren't coming back. And so it'll be... we'll wait till we get there, but
Are the cows going to do their thing? Do the cows want pizza?
Yeah, really. I could have gotten rid of some of those slices. Now, this was also, I felt, you know, it's a good moment for Willie, who's a character I like quite a bit. And so Willie has a good moment. But this was a moment for Murtaugh to step up.
Yeah.
You know? Especially after 14, where he's had such a great relationship with Claire. And I really wanted that moment at the end for Murtaugh to be the guy to come up with the solution. Oh, and this guy was fantastic. I know we don't see him much, but this poor schnook going out and getting drunk when looking for the cows. And here are the cows. And they were perfect. They were great.
They hit their mark.
They hit
their lines.
Absolutely. There was not a problem. It didn't set us back. They just milled around. There
something
you go.
Nicely impish about Murtaugh.
Yeah, I know. It's not. It's something that Duncan kind of brings to it.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. 1:15. One more left. But next week is a really funny one, so you're going to enjoy that.
So I'll see you next week, bro.
We'll see you next week.
Take care.
Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you later.
Yep.